This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Power of Six by Pittacus Lore, performed by Neil Kaplan and Marisol Ramirez.
The events in this book are real. Names and places have been changed to protect the Lorien Six, who remain in hiding. Other civilizations do exist. Some of them seek to destroy you. Chapter 1. My name is Marina, as of the sea, but I wasn't called that until much later. In the beginning, I was known merely as Seven, one of the nine surviving guard from the planet Lorien, the fate of which was, and still is, left in our hands. Those of us who aren't lost. Those of us still alive. I was six when we landed, when the ship jolted to a halt on Earth. Even at my young age, I sensed how much was at stake for us. Nine Saipan, nine guard, and that our only chance waited for us here. We had entered the planet's atmosphere in the midst of a storm of our own creation, and as our feet found Earth for the very first time, I remember the wisps of steam that rolled off the ship and the goosebumps that covered my arms. I hadn't felt the wind in a year, and it was freezing outside. Somebody was there waiting for us. I don't know who he was, only that he handed each Saipan two sets of clothes and a large envelope. I still don't know what was in it. As a group, we huddled together, knowing we might never see one another again. Words were spoken, hugs were given, and then we split up, as we knew we must, walking in pairs in nine different directions. I kept peering over my shoulder as the others receded in the distance, until very slowly, one by one, they all disappeared. And then it was just Adelina and me, alone. I realize now just how scared Adelina must have been. I remember boarding a ship headed to some unknown destination. I remember two or three different trains after that. Adelina and I kept to ourselves, huddled against each other in obscure corners, away from whoever might be around. We hiked from town to town, over mountains and across fields, knocking on doors that were quickly slammed in our faces. We were hungry, tired, and scared. I remember sitting on a sidewalk, begging for change. I remember crying instead of sleeping. I'm certain that Adelina gave away some of our precious gems from Lorien for nothing more than warm meals, so great was our need. Perhaps she gave them all away. And then we found this place in Spain. A stern-looking woman I would come to know as Sister Lucia answered the heavy oak door. She squinted at Adelina, taking in her desperation, the way her shoulders drooped. "Do you believe in the word of God?" the woman asked in Spanish, pursing her lips and narrowing her eyes in scrutiny. "The word of God is my vow," Adelina replied with a solemn nod. I don't know how she knew this response. Perhaps she learned it when we stayed in a church basement weeks before. But it was the right one. Sister Lucia opened the door. We've been here ever since. 11 years in the stone convent with its musty rooms, drafty hallways, and hard floors like slabs of ice. Aside from the few visitors, the internet is my only source to the world outside our small town, and I search it constantly, looking for some indication that the others are out there, that they're searching, maybe fighting. Some sign that I'm not alone, because at this point, I can't say that Adelina still believes, that she's still with me. Her attitude changed somewhere over the mountains. Maybe it was with the slam of one of the doors that shut a starving woman and her child out in the cold for another night. Whatever it was, Adelina seems to have lost the urgency of staying on the move, and her faith in the resurgence of Lorien seems to have been replaced by the faith shared by the convent sisters. I remember a distinct shift in Adelina's eyes. Her sudden speeches on the need for guidance and structure if we were to survive. My faith in Lorien remains intact. In India, a year and a half ago, four different people witnessed a boy move objects with his mind. While the significance behind the event was small at first, the boy's abrupt disappearance shortly thereafter created much buzz in the region, and a hunt for him began. As far as I know, he hasn't been found. A few months ago, there was news of a girl in Argentina who, in the wake of an earthquake, lifted a 5-ton slab of concrete to save a man trapped beneath it. And when news of this heroic act spread, she disappeared. Like the boy in India, she's still missing. And then there's the father-son duo making all the news now in America, in Ohio, who the police are hunting after the two allegedly demolished an entire school by themselves, killing 5 people in the process. They left no trace behind other than mysterious heaps of ash. It looks like a battle took place here. I don't know how else to explain it, the head investigator was quoted as saying. But make no mistake, we will get to the bottom of this. And we will find Henri Smith and his son John. Perhaps John Smith, if that's his real name, is merely a boy with a grudge who was pushed too far. But I don't think that's the case. My heart races whenever his picture appears on my screen. I'm gripped with a profound desperation that I can't quite explain. I can feel it in my bones that he's one of us. And I know somehow that I must find him. Chapter 2. I perch my arms on the cold windowsill and watch the snowflakes fall from the dark sky and settle on the side of the mountain, which is dotted with pine, cork oak, and beech trees, with patches of craggy rock mixed throughout. The snow hasn't let up all day, and they say it will continue through the night. I can barely see beyond the edge of town to the north, the world lost in a white haze. During the day, when the sky is clear, it's possible to see the watery blue smudge of the Bay of Biscay, but not in this weather, and I can't help but wonder what might lurk in all that white beyond my line of sight. I look behind me. In the high-ceilinged, drafty room, there are 2 computers. To use one, we must add our name to a list and wait our turn. At night, there's a 10-minute time limit if somebody is waiting, 20 minutes if there isn't. The 2 girls using them now have been on for a half hour each, and my patience is thin. I haven't checked the news since this morning, when I snuck in before breakfast. At that time, nothing new about John Smith had been reported, but I'm almost shaking in anticipation over what might have sprung up since then. Some new discovery has been uncovered each day since the story first broke. Santa Teresa is a convent that doubles as an orphanage for girls. I am now the oldest out of 37, a distinction I've held for 6 months after the last girl who turned 18 left. At 18, we must all make the choice to strike out on our own or to forge a life within the church. The birthday Adelina and I created for me when we arrived is less than 5 months away. And that's when I'll turn 18, too. Of all who've reached 18, not a single girl has stayed. I can't blame them. Like the others, I have every intention of leaving this prison behind, whether or not Adelina comes with me. And it's hard to imagine she will. The convent itself was built entirely of stone in 1510, and is much too large for the small number of us who live here. Most of the rooms stand empty, and those that aren't are imbued with a damp, earthy feel, and our voices echo to the ceiling and back. The convent rests atop the highest hill overlooking the village that shares the same name, nestled deep within the Picos de Europa mountains of northern Spain. The village, like the convent, is made of rock, with many structures built straight into the mountainside. Walking down the town's main road, Calle Principal, it's impossible not to be inundated by the disrepair. It's as though this place was forgotten by time, and the passing centuries have turned most everything to shades of mossy green and brown, while a pervasive smell of mildew hangs in the air. It's been 5 years since I started begging Adelina to leave, to keep moving like we were instructed to. I'm going to be getting my legacies soon, and I don't want to discover them here with all of these girls and nuns around, I said. She had refused, quoting La Biblia Reina Valera, that we must stand still for salvation. I begged every year since, and every year she looks at me with blank eyes and talks me down with a different religious quote. But I know my salvation does not lie here. Past the church gates and down the gently sloping hill, I can see the faint dimness of the town lights. In the midst of this blizzard, they look like floating halos. Though I can't hear the music from either of the two cantinas, I'm sure both of them are packed. Aside from those, there is a restaurant, a cafe, a market, a bodega, and various vendors that line Calle Principal most mornings and afternoons. Towards the bottom of the hill, on the southern edge of town, is the brick school we all attend. My head snaps around when the bell dings. Prayers are 5 minutes away, followed directly by bed. Panic sweeps through me. I have to know if anything new has been reported. Perhaps John's been caught. Perhaps the police have found something else at the demolished school. Something originally overlooked. Even if there's nothing new at all, I have to know. I'll never get to sleep otherwise. I fix a hard stare on Gabriela Garcia. Gabby, for short, who sits at one of the computers. Gabby's 16 and very pretty, with long dark hair and brown eyes, and she always dresses slutty when she's outside the convent, wearing tight shirts that show off her pierced navel. Every morning, she dresses in loose, baggy clothes, but the second we're out of sight of the sisters, she removes them, revealing a tight, skimpy outfit underneath. Then she spends the rest of the walk to school applying makeup and redoing her hair. It's the same with her four friends, three of whom also live here. And when the day ends, they wipe their faces clean during the walk back and redress in their original clothes. "What?" Gabby asks in a snotty voice, glaring at me. "I'm writing an email." "I've been waiting longer than 10 minutes, I say. "And you're not writing an email. You're looking at guys with their shirts off." "So what? Are you going to tell on me? Tattletale?" she asks mockingly. The girl beside her, whose name is Hilda, but who most kids in school call La Gorda, the fat one, behind her back, never to her face, laughs. They're an inseparable pair, Gabby and La Gorda. I bite my tongue and turn back to the window, folding my arms across my chest. I'm seething inside, partly because I need to get on the computer, and partly because I never know how to respond when Gabby mocks me. There are 4 minutes left. My impatience segues to full-on desperation. There could be news right now, breaking news. But I have no way of knowing because these selfish jerks won't give up one of the computers. 3 minutes left. I'm nearly shaking with anger. And then an idea pops into my head, and a grin plays across my lips. It's risky, but worth it if it works. I pivot, just enough to see Gabby's chair in my peripheral vision. I take a deep breath, and, focusing all my energy on her chair, use my telekinesis to jerk it to the left. Then I quickly thrust it right so hard it nearly topples over. Gabby jumps up and yelps. I look at her in mock surprise.
What?
LaGorda asks.
I don't know. I feel like somebody just kicked my chair or something. Did you feel anything?
No,
LaGorda says. And as soon as the word is uttered, I move her chair a few centimeters backwards, then jerk it to the right, all the while remaining at my spot by the window. Both of the girls scream this time. I thrust Gabby's chair, then LaGorda's again, and without giving their computer screens a second glance, they flee the room, screaming as they go. Yes, I say, rushing to the computer Gabby was using and quickly typing the web address of the news site I've deemed most reliable. Then I wait impatiently for the page to load. The old computers combined with the slow internet here are the bane of my existence. The browser goes white, and, line by line, the page forms. When a quarter of it has loaded, the final bell rings. 1 minute until prayers. I'm inclined to ignore the bell, even at the risk of being punished. At this point, I don't really care. 5 more months, I whisper to myself. Half of the page is now up, revealing the top of John Smith's face, his upturned eyes, which are dark and confident, though within them, there's a sense of discomfort that seems almost out of place. I lean on the edge of my seat, waiting, the excitement bubbling up inside me, causing my hands to tremble. Come on, I say to the screen, trying in vain to hurry it. Come on, come on, come on!
Marina?
A voice barks from the open doorway. I jerk around and see Sister Dora, a portly woman who's the head cook in the kitchen, staring daggers at me. This is nothing new. She stares daggers at everyone who walks through the lunch line holding a tray, as though our needing sustenance is a personal affront. She presses her lips together in a perfect straight line, then narrows her eyes.
Come! Now! And I mean right now!
I sigh, knowing I have no choice but to go. I clear the browser's history and close it. Then follow Sister Dora down the dark hallway. There was something new on that screen. I just know it. Why else would John's face have taken up the entire page? A week and a half is long enough for any news to turn stale. So for him to command so much of the screen means there's some significant new piece of information. We walk to Santa Teresa's nave, which is huge. Towering pillars lead to a high, vaulted ceiling, and stained glass windows line the walls. Wooden pews run the length of the open room and can seat nearly 300 people. Sister Dora and I are the last to enter. I sit alone in one of the center pews. Sister Lucia, who opened the door to Adelina and me when we first arrived, and who still runs the convent, stands at the pulpit, closes her eyes, lowers her head, and presses her hands together in front of her. Everyone else does the same.
Padre Divino, the prayer begins in somber unison. Que nos bendiga y nos proteja en su amor.
I tune it out and look at the back of the heads before me, all of which are bowed in concentration. Or just bowed. My eyes find Adelina, sitting in the very first row, 6 pews in front of me, and slightly to the right. She is on her knees, deeply meditative, her brown hair pulled into a tight braid that falls to the middle of her back. She doesn't look up once, doesn't try to find me at the back of the room like she used to during our first few years here. A covert smile on each of our faces as our eyes met, acknowledging our shared secret. We still share that secret, but somewhere along the way, Adelina has stopped acknowledging it. Somewhere along the way, the plan to bide our time until we felt strong enough and safe enough to leave has been replaced with Adelina's desire to simply stay, or her fear to leave. Before the news of John Smith, which I'd told Adelina about when it broke, it had been months since we last talked about our mission. In September, I'd shown her my third scar, the third warning, that said another guard has died, and that she and I are one step closer to being hunted and killed by the Mogadorians. And she had acted like it didn't exist, like it didn't mean what we both know it means. Upon hearing the news about John, she merely rolled her eyes and told me to stop believing in fairy tales.
En el nombre del Padre, y del Hijo, y del Espíritu Santo. Amen.
They say, and everyone in the room makes the sign of the cross in unison with this last sentence, myself included, to keep up appearances. Forehead, chest, left shoulder, right shoulder. I had been asleep, dreaming of running down a mountain with my arms out at my sides, as if I was about to take flight, when I had been awoken by the pain and glow of the third scar, wrapping itself around my lower leg. The light had woken several girls in the room, but thankfully not the attending sister. The girls thought I had a flashlight and a magazine under the covers, and that I was breaking the rules of curfew. On the bed next to mine, Elena, a quiet 16-year-old with jet black hair she often sticks in her mouth when speaking, had thrown a pillow at me. My flesh had begun to bubble, and the pain had been so intense I had to bite on the edge of my blanket to remain quiet. I couldn't help but cry, because somewhere number three had lost his or her life. There were six of us left now. Tonight I file out of the nave with the rest of the girls and head to our sleeping quarters filled with creaky twin beds evenly spaced apart. But in my mind, I am hatching a plan. To compensate for the hard beds and the concrete chill of every room, the linens are soft and the blankets heavy, the only real luxury we're afforded. My bed is in the back corner, farthest from the door, which is the most sought-after spot. It's the quietest, and it took me a long time to get it, moving one bed closer as each girl left. The lights are shut off once everyone is settled in. I lie on my back and stare at the faint, jagged outline of the high ceiling. An occasional whisper breaks the silence, followed immediately by the attending sister shushing whoever it came from. I keep my eyes open, waiting impatiently for everyone to fall asleep. After a half hour, the whispers fade, replaced by the soft sounds of sleep. But I don't dare risk it yet. Too soon. Another 15 minutes, and still no sounds. Then, I can't stand it any longer. I hold my breath and inch my legs over the edge of the bed, listening to the rhythm of Elena's breathing beside me. My feet find the icy floor and turn cold instantly. I stand slowly to keep the bed from creaking, and then tiptoe across the room and towards the door. Taking my time, being careful not to bump any beds. I reach the open doorway and rush out into the hall and down to the computer room. I pull out the chair and push the computer's power button. I fidget, waiting for the computer to boot up, and keep peering towards the hallway to see if anyone has followed. I'm finally able to type in the web address and the screen goes white. Then two pictures take shape in the center of the page, surrounded by text with a top headline in bold black letters too blurry to read. Two images now. I wonder what changed since I tried to check earlier. And then, at last, they come into focus. International terrorists? John Smith, with his square jaw, shaggy dark blonde hair, and blue eyes, fills the left side of the screen, while his father, or more likely, Saipan, Henri, takes up the right. What's there isn't a photo, but a black and white artist's sketch done in pencil. I skim the details I already know. Demolished school, five deaths, abrupt disappearance, and then come to the breaking news only now being reported. In a bizarre twist, FBI investigators today uncovered what is believed to be the tools of a professional counterfeiter. Several machines, typically used for the creation of documents, were found in the Paradise, Ohio home rented by Henri and John Smith. in a hatch beneath the floorboards of the master bedroom, leading investigators to consider possible links to terrorism. Creating local uproar within the Paradise community, Henri and John Smith are now considered a threat to national security, fugitives, and investigators are asking for any and all information that might lead to their whereabouts. I scroll back to John's image, and when my gaze meets his, my hands begin to shake. His eyes, even in this sketch, there's something familiar about them. How could I know them if not from the year-long journey that brought us here? Nobody can convince me now that he isn't one of the six remaining guard, still alive in this foreign world. I lean back and blow my bangs out of my eyes, wishing I could go in search of John myself. Of course Henri and John Smith are able to elude police. They've kept hidden for 11 years now, just as Adelina and I have. But how can I possibly hope to be the one to find him when the whole world is looking? How can any of us hope to come together? The eyes of the Mogadorians are everywhere. I have no idea how one or three were found, but I believe they located two because of a blog post he or she had written. I had found it, and then I'd sat there for 15 minutes thinking how best to respond without giving myself away. Though the message itself had been obscure, it was very obvious to those of us looking. 9. Now 8. Are the rest of you out there? It had been posted by an account called 2. My fingers found the keyboard, and I had typed a quick response, and just before I hit the post button, the page refreshed. Somebody else had responded first. "We are here," it read. My mouth had dropped open, and I'd stared in utter shock. Hope flooded through me from those two brief messages. But just as my fingers had typed a different reply, a bright glow appeared at my feet, and the sizzling sound of burning flesh reached my ears, followed closely by a searing pain so great that I dropped to the floor and writhed in agony, screaming at the top of my lungs for Adelina, holding my hands over my ankles so no one else would see. When Adelina arrived and realized what was happening, I'd pointed at the screen, but it was blank. Both posts had been deleted. I look away from John Smith's familiar eyes on the screen. Beside the computer sits a small flower that's been forgotten. It's wilted and tired, shrunken down to half its normal height, a brown, crispy tinge at the edge of its leaves. Several petals have dropped, now dry and crinkled on the desk around the pot. The flower isn't dead yet, but it's not far off. I lean forward and cup my hands around it, move my face near enough so that my lips brush against the edge of its leaves, and then I blow hot air over it. An icy feeling shoots down my spine, and in response, life bursts through the small flower. It springs upward, and a verdant green floods the leaves and stalk, and new petals bloom, colorless at first, then turning a brilliant purple. A mischievous grin sprouts on my face, and I can't help but think of how the sisters would react if they were to see such a thing. But I'll never let them. It would be misinterpreted, and I don't want to be cast out into the cold. I'm not ready for that. Soon, but not just yet. I turn off the computer and hurry back to bed while thoughts of John Smith, somewhere out there, swim in my head. Be safe, and stay hidden, I think. We'll find each other yet.
Chapter 3. A low whisper finds me. The voice is cold. I can't seem to move, but I listen intently. I'm not asleep anymore. But I'm not awake either. I'm paralyzed, and as the whispers increase, my eyes are whisked away through the impenetrable darkness of my motel room. The electricity I feel as the vision breaks above my bed reminds me
of when my first legacy, Lumen, lit up my palms in Paradise, Ohio. Back when Henri was still here, still alive. But Henri's gone now. He's not coming back. Even in this state, I can't escape that reality. I completely enter the vision above me, blazing through its darkness with my hands turned on. But the glow is swallowed by the shadows. And then I snap to a halt. Everything falls silent. I lift my hands in front of me, but touch nothing. My feet off the ground, floating in a great void. More whispering in a language I don't recognize, but somehow still understand. The words burst forth anxiously. The darkness fades, and the world I'm in turns a shade of gray on its way to a white so bright I have to squint to see. A mist drifts in front of me and filters away, revealing a large, open room with candles lining the walls.
I don't know what went wrong,
a voice says, clearly shaken. The room is long and wide, the size of a football field. The acrid smell of sulfur burns my nostrils, makes my eyes water. The air is hot and stuffy. And then I see them at the far end of the room. Two figures, shrouded in shadows, one much bigger than the other, and menacing even from a distance.
They got away. Somehow they got away. I don't know how.
I move forward. I feel the sort of calm that sometimes comes in dreams when you're aware you're asleep, and that nothing can really hurt you. Step by step, nearing the growing shadows.
All of them killed, along with three Pykin and two Krolls,
the smaller of the two says, standing with fidgeting hands beside the larger man.
We had them. We were about to,
comes the voice, but the other cuts him off. He scans the air to see what he's already sensed. I stop, stand motionless, and hold my breath. And then he finds me. A shudder runs up my spine.
John?
Somebody says, the voice a distant echo. The larger figure comes towards me. He towers over me, 20 feet tall, muscular, a chiseled jaw. His hair isn't long like the others, but cut short instead. His skin is tan. Our eyes stay locked as he slowly approaches, 30 feet away, then 20. He stops 10 feet short. My pendant grows heavy, and the chain cuts into my neck. Around his throat, like a collar, I notice a grotesque purplish scar.
I've been expecting you,
he says, his voice level and calm. He lifts his right arm and pulls a sword from the sheath on his back. It comes alive at once, keeping its shape while the metal turns nearly liquid. The wound in my shoulder, from the soldier's dagger during the battle in Ohio, screams with pain as though I'm being stabbed all over again. I fall to my knees.
It's been a very long time, he says.
I don't know what you're talking about, I say in a language I've never spoken before. I want to leave immediately, wherever this place is. I try to rise, but it's as if I'm suddenly stuck to the ground.
Don't you?
He asks.
John,
I hear again from somewhere on the periphery. The Mogadorian doesn't seem to notice, and there's something about his gaze that holds my own. I can't look away. I'm not supposed to be here, I say. My voice sounds watery. Everything dims until it's just the two of us and nothing else.
I can make you disappear if that's what you want,
he says, slashing a figure eight with the sword, leaving a stark white streak hanging in the air where the blade passes through. And then he charges, his sword held high and cracking with power. He swings, and it comes down like a bullet aimed for my throat, and I know that there's nothing I can do to stop the blow from decapitating me.
John!
The voice screams again. My eyes whip open. Two hands grip me hard by the shoulders. I'm covered in sweat and out of breath. I focus first on Sam standing over me, then on Six, with her stark hazel eyes that sometimes look blue and sometimes green, kneeling beside me, appearing tired and worn as though I just woke her, which I probably did.
What was that all about?
Sam asks. I shake my head, letting the vision dissipate, and I take in my surroundings. The room is dark, with the curtains drawn, and I'm lying in the same bed I've spent the last week and a half in, healing from the battle wounds. Six has been recovering beside me, and neither she nor I have left this place since we arrived, relying on Sam to head out for food and supplies. A shabby motel room with two full beds off the main street in Trucksville, North Carolina. To rent the room, Sam had used one of the 17 driver's licenses Henri created for me before he was killed. And luckily, the old man at the front desk was too busy watching TV to study the photograph. Situated on the northwestern edge of the state, the motel is a 15-minute drive from both Virginia and Tennessee, a location chosen mainly because we had traveled as far as we could go, given the extent of our injuries. But our wounds have slowly healed, and our strength is finally returning.
You were talking in a foreign language I'd never heard before, Sam says. I think you made it up, dude.
No, he was talking in Mogadorian,
Six corrects him,
and even a little Loric.
Really?
I ask.
That's totally weird.
Six walks to the window and pulls back the right side of the curtains.
What were you dreaming about?
I shake my head. I'm not really sure. I was dreaming, but I wasn't dreaming, you know. Having visions, I guess. And they were about them. We were about to have a battle. But I was, I don't know, too weak or confused or something. I look up at Sam, who is frowning and looking at the TV.
What? Bad news, he sighs, shaking his head.
What? I sit up, wipe the sleep from my eyes. Sam nods to the front of the room, and I turn to the glow of the television. My face takes up the entire left half of the screen, while an artist's rendering of Henri's is on the right. The drawing looks nothing like him. His face seems sharp and haggard to the point of emaciation, giving him the appearance of being 20 years older than he really is, or was.
As if being called a threat to national security or a terrorist wasn't bad enough, Sam says. They're now offering a reward.
For me? I ask.
For you and Henri. $100,000 for any information leading to your and Henri's capture, and $250,000 if somebody brings either of you in on their own, Sam says.
I've been on the run all of my life, I say, rubbing my eyes. What difference does it make?
Yeah, well, I haven't, and they're offering a reward for me, too, Sam says. A measly $25,000, if you can believe that. And I don't know how good of a fugitive I am. I've never done this before.
I gingerly scoot up the bed, still a little stiff. Sam sits on the other bed and places his head in his palms. You're with us, though, Sam.
We have your back, I say. I'm not worried, he says into his chest. I chew on the insides of my cheeks, thinking about how I'm going to keep him safe, and me, and Six alive, without Henri. I turn to face Sam, who is stressed enough to be picking a hole in his black NASA t-shirt. Listen, Sam. I wish Henri was here. I can't even tell you how much I wish he was here, for so many reasons. Not only did he keep me safe when we were running from one state to the next, but he also had all this knowledge about Lorien and my family, and he had this amazing calming way about him that's kept us out of trouble for so long. I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to do what he did to keep us safe. I bet if he were alive today, he wouldn't have let you come with us. There's just no way he would have put you in this kind of danger. But listen, you're here, and that's that. And I promise that I won't let anything happen to you. I want to be here, Sam says. This is the coolest thing that's ever happened to me. There's a pause, and then he looks me in the eyes. Plus, you're my best friend, and I've never had a best friend. Neither have I, I say. Just hug already, Six says. Sam and I laugh. My face is still on the screen. The photo on the TV is the one Sarah took on my very first day of school, the day I'd met her. And I have an awkward, uncomfortable look on my face. The right side of the screen is now filled with smaller photos of the five people we're being accused of killing. Three teachers, the men's basketball coach, the school janitor. And then the screen changes yet again to images of the wrecked school. And it really is wrecked. The entire right side of the building is nothing more than a heap of rubble. Next come various interviews with Paradise residents, the last being Sam's mom. When she comes on screen, she's crying, and looking straight into the camera, she desperately pleads with the kidnappers to please, please, please return my baby safely to me. When Sam sees this interview, I can tell something inside of him shifts. Scenes from the past week's funerals and candlelight vigils come next. Sarah's face flashes on the screen, and she's holding a candle as tears stream down her cheeks. A lump forms in my throat. I'd give anything to hear her voice. It kills me to imagine what she must be dealing with. The video of us escaping Mark's burning house, which is what started all of this, has blown up on the internet. And while I was blamed for starting that blaze as well, Mark stepped in and swore up and down that I had no part in it, even though using me as a scapegoat would have let him off the hook completely. When we had left Ohio, the damage to the school had first been attributed to an out-of-season tornado. But then rescue crews filtered through the rubble, and in no time, all five bodies had been found lying equal distances from each other, without a single mark on them, in a room untouched by the battle. Autopsies reported that they had died of natural causes, with no trace of drugs or trauma. Who knows how it really happened? When one of the reporters had heard the story of me jumping through the principal's window and running away from the school, and then when Henri and I couldn't be found, he'd run a story blaming us for everything. And the rest had been quick to follow. With the recent discovery of Henri's forgery tools, along with a few of the fake documents he had left at the house, the public outrage has grown.
We're going to have to be very careful now, Six says, sitting against the wall.
More careful than staying inside a crummy motel room with the curtains drawn? I ask. Six goes back to the window and pulls aside one of the curtains to peer out.
A sliver of sunlight cuts across the floor. The sun will set in 3 hours. Let's leave as soon as it's dark.
Thank God, Sam says. There's a meteor shower tonight we can see if we drive south. Plus, if I have to spend one more minute inside this crappy room, I'm going to go nuts.
Sam, you've been nuts since the first time I met you,
I kid. He throws a pillow at me, which I deflect without lifting a hand. I twist the pillow over and over in the air with my telekinesis, and then send it like a rocket at the television, shutting it off. I know Six is right that we should keep moving, but I'm frustrated. It seems like there's no end in sight, no place where we'll be safe. At the foot of the bed, keeping my feet warm, is Bernie Kosar, who's hardly left my side since Ohio. He opens his eyes and yawns and stretches. He peers up at me and through my telepathy communicates that he's also feeling better. Most of the small scabs that covered his body are gone, and the larger ones are healing nicely. He's still wearing the makeshift splint on his broken front leg, and he'll limp for a few more weeks, but he almost looks like his old self. He offers a subtle wag and paws at my leg. I reach down and pull him up to my lap and scratch his tummy. How about you, buddy? You ready to get out of this dump? Bernie Kosar thumps his tail against the bed. So? Where to, guys? I ask.
I don't know, Six says. Preferably somewhere warm to ride out the winter. I'm pretty sick of this snow. Though I'm even more sick of not knowing where the others are.
For now, it's just us three. 4 plus 6 plus Sam.
I love algebra, Sam says. Sam equals X. Variable X.
Such a nerd, dude, I say. Six enters the bathroom and then exits a second later with a handful of toiletries.
If there's any consolation in what happened, at least the other guard, No John, not only survived his first battle, but that he won it. Maybe they'll find a bit of hope in it. Our biggest priority now is finding the others and training together in the meantime.
We will, I say, then look at Sam. It's not too late to go back and put things straight, Sam. You can make up any story about us you want. Tell them we kidnapped you and held you against your will, and that you escaped the first chance you got. You'll be considered a hero. Girls will be all over you. Sam bites his lower lip and shakes his head.
I don't want to be a hero, and girls are already all over me.
Six and I roll our eyes, but I also see Six blush. Or maybe I imagine it.
I mean it, he says. I'm not leaving.
I shrug. I guess that's settled. Sam equals X in this equation. Sam watches Six walk to her small duffel bag beside the TV, and his attraction to her is painted all over his face. She's wearing black cotton shorts and a white tank top with her hair pulled back. A few strands fall loose around her face. A purple scar is prominent on the front of her left thigh, and the stitch marks around it are a tender pink, still scabbed over. Stitches she not only sewed herself, but also removed. When Six looks up, Sam shyly diverts his gaze. Clearly there's another reason Sam wants to stick around. Six bends down and reaches into her bag, removing a folded map. She opens it on the foot of the bed.
Right here, she says, pointing to Trucksville, is where we are. And here, she continues, moving her finger from North Carolina to a tiny red star made in ink close to the center of West Virginia, is where the Mogadorian's cave is. The one I know of, anyhow.
I look where she's pointing.
Even on the map, it's obvious the location is very isolated. There doesn't appear to be any sort of main road within 5 miles, nor any town within 10. How do you even know where the cave is?
That's a long story, she says. Probably one better left for the road.
Her finger takes up a new route on the map, heading southwest from West Virginia, traversing Tennessee, and coming to rest on a point in Arkansas near the Mississippi River. What's there? I ask. She puffs her cheeks and releases a deep breath, undoubtedly remembering something that happened. Her face takes on a special look when deep in concentration.
This is where my chest was, she says. And some of the stuff Katarina brought from Lorien, this is where we hid it.
What do you mean where it was? She shakes her head. It's not there anymore?
No, they were tracking us, and we couldn't risk them getting it. It was no longer safe with us, so we stowed it and Katarina's artifacts in Arkansas and fled as fast as we could, thinking we could stay ahead of them.
She trails off. They caught up to you, didn't they? I ask, knowing her Sepong, Katarina, died 3 years ago. She sighs.
That's another story better left for the road.
It takes minutes to throw my clothes into my duffel bag. And as I'm doing it, I realize the last time this bag was packed, Sarah had done it. Only a week and a half has passed, but it feels like a year and a half. I wonder if she's been interrogated by police or singled out at school. Where's she even going to school, since the high school was destroyed? I'm certain she can hold her own. But still, it can't be easy on her, especially since she has no idea where I am, or even if I'm okay. I wish I could contact her without putting us both in danger. Sam turns the TV back on, the old-fashioned way, with the remote. And he watches the news while Six goes invisible to check on the truck. We assume Sam's mom noticed it missing, which surely means the police are keeping an eye out for it. Earlier in the week, Sam stole the front license plate off another truck. It might help us until we get to where we're going. I finish packing and set my bag beside the door. Sam smiles when his picture pops up on the television screen, again on the same news cycle, and I know he's enjoying his small bit of celebrity, even at the risk of being considered a fugitive. Then they show my picture again, which means they also show Henri's. It rips me apart to see him, even though the sketch looks nothing like him. Now isn't the time for guilt or misery. But I miss him so much. It's my fault he's dead. 15 minutes later, Six walks in carrying a white plastic bag. She holds up the bag and shakes it at us.
I bought you guys something.
Yeah? What is it? I ask. She reaches in and pulls out a pair of hair clippers.
I think it's time for a haircut for you and Sam.
Oh, come on. My head's too small. It's going to make me look like a turtle, Sam objects.
I laugh and try to picture him without his shaggy hair. He has a long, skinny neck, and I think he might be right.
You'll be incognito, Six replies.
Well, I don't want to be incognito. I'm Variable X.
Stop being a wuss,
Six says. He scowls. I try to be upbeat. Yeah, Sam, I say, peeling off my shirt. Six follows me into the bathroom, ripping the packaging away from the clippers as I bend over the tub. Her fingers are a little cold, and goosebumps sprinkle down my spine. I wish it was Sarah who was holding my shoulder steady and giving me a makeover. Sam watches from the doorway, sighing loudly, making his displeasure known. Six finishes, and I wipe away the loose hair with a towel, then stand and look in the mirror. My head is whiter than the rest of my face, but only because it's never seen the sun. I think that a few days in the Florida Keys, where Henri and I lived before coming to Ohio, would fix the problem in no time.
See? John looks tough and rugged like that. I'm going to look like a turd, Sam groans.
I am tough and rugged, Sam, I reply. He rolls his eyes while Six cleans the clippers.
Down,
she says. Sam obeys, dropping to his knees and bending over the tub. When she's done, Sam stands and flashes me a pleading look.
How bad is it?
You look good, buddy, I say. You look like a fugitive. Sam rubs his head a few times and finally looks in the mirror. He cringes.
I look like an alien, he exclaims in mock disgust, then glances at me over his shoulder. No offense, he adds lamely.
Six collects all the hair from the tub and drops it in the toilet, careful to flush every strand. She coils the cord of the clippers into a neat, tight loop, then slips it back into its bag.
No time like the present, she says.
We strap our bags across her shoulders, and she grabs them both with her hands, then makes herself invisible, causing the bags to disappear as well. She rushes out the door to take them to the truck without being seen. While she's gone, I reach up into the far right corner of the closet, toss aside a few towels, and grab the Lorik chest.
You ever gonna open that thing or what? Sam asks.
He's been excited to see what's inside ever since I told him about it. Yeah, I will, I say, as soon as I feel safe. The motel door opens, then closes. Six reappears and glances at the chest.
I won't be able to make you and Sam disappear and that, only what I hold in my hands. I'll run it back to the truck first.
No, that's okay. Take Sam with you, and I'll follow behind.
That's stupid, John. How are you going to follow behind?
I pull on my hat and jacket, then zip it, and pull the hood over my head so that only my face shows.
I'll be fine.
I have advanced hearing like you, I say. She eyes me skeptically and shakes her head. I grab Bernie Kosar's leash and clip it to his collar. Only until we get to the truck, I tell him, since he hates walking on a leash. On second thought, I lean down to carry him, since his leg is still healing, but he tells me he'd rather walk himself. Ready when you are, I say.
All right, let's do this,
Six says. Sam offers his hand to her a little too enthusiastically. I stifle a laugh.
What?
He asks. I shake my head. Nothing. I'll follow you as best I can, but don't get too far ahead.
Just cough if you can't follow and we'll stop. The truck is only a few minutes walk from here, behind the abandoned barn, Six says. Can't miss it.
As the door flings open, Sam and Six disappear. That's our cue, BK. Just the two of us now. He follows me out, trotting happily with his tongue dangling. Aside from quick bathroom trips to the small plot of grass beside the motel, Bernie Kosar's been cooped up like the rest of us. The night air is cool and fresh. Carrying a scent of pine and the wind on my face brings me instantly back to life. As I walk, I close my eyes and try to sense Six by combing the air with my mind, reaching out and feeling the landscape with telekinesis. The same way I was able to stop the speeding bullet in Athens, by grabbing everything in the air. I feel them, a few feet ahead of me and slightly to the right. I give Six a nudge and she startles, her breath catching in her throat. 3 seconds later, she shook.